You're listening to a podcast from the Rocking Vicar.
Coming up on this week's Parish Council, was Dolly miming? Does it really matter? Big changes at Five Live and Absolute Radio. ITV1's The Betrayers reviewed, and two smoking tracks are added to the pretend iPod.
Hello everybody, and welcome once again to the podcast called The Parish Council. It comes from the Rocking Vicar. I'm Agnes Shaw, and he's a disco duck. He's Terence Sutton.
Hello, Magnus Shaw. Hello. Yeah, quackety quack to you. Yes, I've got a question for you. It's almost as if, you know, if people didn't know us better, yes. It was almost as if I'd been queued up to ask you a question.
Oh, but yeah,
exactly. People know how spontaneous this is. Yes. Magnus Shaw, uh-huh. Have you been listening to any 80s radio recently?
Well, as there is only one 80s radio station in the UK, which is Absolute Radio 80s, yes, I have. That's the one I've been listening to. I used to listen to Absolute Radio 90s quite habitually. Then I think I've exhausted their playlist. I've just started to realise that. I think I've probably been through the 500 records that are loaded onto the database for Radio Absolute Radio 90s at least twice each. So I've switched to 80s now. Which okay. I'm enjoying because it's all fresh playlists for me. And one of the tracks I heard this week was, I'm sure you'll remember this. This was a one-off number one. In fact, a one-off hit for a lady from Germany called Naina. You remember Naina?
Oh, Naina, her 99 Luftballons.
Yes, exactly. Well, that was the track. Yes, yeah. And actually, just looking her up, she did a single with Kim Wilde, but duet that did very little. But I never knew that. I only found that out yesterday. Anyway, that was by the by.
Okay.
This was the English version of Neune
Luftballons,
which translates as we all know to 99 red balloons. Now, in the opening verse,
okay,
and this is the kind of thing that occupies my day, which makes me perhaps sadder than most. In the opening verse, she buys a bag of balloons with the money she's got. She actually says that. You and I, in a little toy shop, buy a bag of balloons with the money we've got, is what she actually says. And then she sets them free, and if you follow the narrative of the song, they glide across the German sky, across the Iron Curtain, and trigger a nuclear alert.
Crikey.
That's what the song is about. Yes, crikey indeed.
Who knew?
Who knew, exactly. Well, nice story, but I'm just not buying it, Terence, I've got to tell you.
Oh, okay.
And here's why I'm not buying the lyrics. Right. To Naina's Neune Luftballons. I don't think you get 99 balloons in a bag when you buy them at the toy shop.
I take your point.
30 at the most.
30 at the most, but more pertinently,
yes.
Is a toy shop going to stock 99 filled balloons? I mean, it'd have to be the size of the biggest warehouse, like a macro warehouse or something, get 99...
Well, I think it's quite explicit that they are deflated when she...
Oh, they're deflated. Well, fair enough. So she must have a lot of puff, must
yeah.
Naina.
Yeah, but she specifically... Well, yes, she must, yes, and she specifically says... They buy one bag of balloons. We buy a bag of balloons with the money we've got.
Yeah, but hang on, you're saying they're deflated. Yeah. Well, then she could get them in a bag.
Yes, but I don't think in a they come prepackaged. I don't think you get 99 balloons in a bag.
Oh, I see a specific number. You might get them in bags of 10, say, or 12.
No, I suppose it might be an odd shop where you buy them one at a time.
You could buy them one at a time, or perhaps there's some eccentric German shopping model where they buy things in units of 11, and she bought 9 units of balloons, and that's how she ended up with 99 Luftballons.
I also then think if you did buy 99 Luftballons, they wouldn't all be red. I think they come in variety packs of multicolours. In fact, I know they do. I mean, if you've ever bought a bag of balloons, they're all sorts of colours.
I'm now going back to your earlier suggestion that she bought them in single units.
Well, she was fortunate indeed that the shop had almost 100
Well, maybe they bought them in a job lot, you know, and she went through and said, well, there's blue one, I'll put that aside, a green one, we don't want that one. Or it's another red one, here's another red one, and, you know, eventually... You know,
that would have taken a long time, wouldn't it, until she got 99?
It would have done. Yeah. Here's another question, though. If she was then puffing away outside, even if she had help... Mm. From Kim Wilde, or indeed anybody.
Yes.
She was puffing away outside, and she had 99 Luftballons, wouldn't there be a danger that they may sweep her away too into her anti-nuclear protest?
Well, no, you see, this is actually quite the opposite. This is my third and final point you've released.
Thank God, yes.
Is that even if she did manage to buy a pack of balloons, and there were 99 in them, and they were all red.
Yeah.
And she managed to blow them up, and as she says in the lyric, and let them go, she likes these things, and let them go, what would happen? They'd bounce along the ground, wouldn't they? Unless she exhales helium. I don't think she does exhale helium. I think she exhales carbon dioxide.
I think it's unlikely that she exhales helium, because she'd be on something like Germany's Got Talent.
Yeah. Exhaling helium,
the sort of specialist performer.
Yes, and when she kissed her boyfriend, he'd start speaking in a squeaky voice, wouldn't he?
He would indeed. Yeah. So it's an awful lot of reasons to suggest that she doesn't exhale helium and that she's just puffing out.
The balloons would just bounce along the ground. It's this myth that you inflate a balloon and let it go and it soars into the sky is nonsense.
But what if she linked the 99 Luftballons together with an enormous piece of string?
Yes. Well, that doesn't work either, does it? Because they all just go fall to the ground, because carbon dioxide is not lighter than atmospheric air, is it?
There's only one thing for this. You'll need to get hold of Kim Wilde.
Yeah.
And go and buy 99 Luftballons.
Yes.
And you, Kim Wilde and Naina, who I understand is still going strong, just run the experiment, and you'll have to report back to us after having established contact with Naina and Kim Wilde.
They will bounce along the ground. You have to put in a gas that is lighter than atmospheric air for the balloon to rise, otherwise it falls to the ground, no matter how many there are.
You tell me that you live in rural Derbyshire, and that you've mentioned that there's a park nearby your very house.
Yes.
May I suggest that by this time next week you've bought at least... Let's scale it down. Could you buy 9 Luftballons?
Yes, I think so, yes.
Go to the park, tie them together, just let them go without any helium involved, and then report back.
Yep.
You may even want to do a little vine on your mobile device.
Yes,
but that may be a stretch too far. But would you do that, and then let us know, because you've opened up you've disturbed a hornet's nest now. Everybody had forgotten this issue, and you've just brought it back.
Exactly.
The front of people's minds.
Of course, we'd be delighted to spend the afternoon with Naina and Kim Wilde. That would be fabulous.
Yes, and a scaled-down number of Luftballons. it would have to be...
It doesn't matter if they're red, does it? I mean, that doesn't really come into it, does it?
I think, no, we'll waive the colour issue.
Yeah.
Hue, as you say, is not of primary importance here. It's the actual experiment of puffing up a number of Luftballons and seeing what happens to them. Although, of course, Naina may argue that the meteorological conditions in rural Derbyshire are very different to her native Hamburg.
Yes,
but it's the best you can do, let's be honest.
If there is a nuclear alert midweek, you'll know how the experiment has panned out.
We'll all be aware, and we'll all be on to Sky News giving our version of the Magnashaw we knew.
That's right. Exactly.
Now, I tell you what, Magnashaw, here's the thing. Mm. For the third week in succession, let me just refer back briefly to when I went to see the Eagles a couple of weeks ago. It has relevance to a current topic. Because alongside Glenn Frey, Don Henley, Timothy B. Schmidt, Joe Walsh and Bernie Ledden, there were 5 additional musicians on stage helping with the heavy lifting on drums, yeah, keyboards, and especially guitar and vocals. Uh-huh. Well, you know, did this matter? I don't think so. It was all very clear and upfront. There was no attempt to pretend they weren't there. Mm-hmm. They were even introduced one by one to the audience by Glenn Frey. But this week, one of the hottest controversies to emerge in music is this question. Was Dolly Parton miming at Glastonbury last weekend?
Oh, yeah.
We asked our forensic expert, Magna Shaw, to take on this case.
Yeah.
What's the score with Dolly, Magna Shaw?
It's a bit hard, isn't it? I only saw Glastonbury broadcast, and it is a bit hard to establish exactly what's going on stage because you don't know where the feed's coming from. That's the whole point. If you know, is it coming from the monitors, from the desks, from some kind of onstage miking setup? Did the BBC take a completely separate audio feed from the live feed? So it's hard to know what you're seeing. It looked to me in parts like there was some lip syncing, and certainly some Pro Tools. I mean, her voice was double tracked on some songs, but that's okay. You know, that's not uncommon at all to treat the voice through the desk. I think it's really, really hard to say whether she was miming. It appeared that she was, but that could have been the nature of the delay or the syncing of the pictures to the audio feed. My point is, even if she was, it didn't matter because it wasn't that kind of show. I don't mean Glastonbury, I mean Dolly Parton's set. I think had we Jake Bugg, I think the question would have been much more pertinent. But the Dolly Parton show wasn't about an authentic rock experience, was it?
No, it wasn't, no. There's a sort of a juxtaposition here, because Dolly's spokesman said, no, she sings live.
Right.
Some people don't know an amazing singer when they hear one. Well, that sounds pretty definitive, doesn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
But here's the thing.
Yeah.
A touch of research took me back to 2004 and her Hello, I'm Dolly tour.
Okay.
And this is what she wrote. This is what Dolly Parton wrote on her website, Dolly Mania.
Yeah.
In 2004, quote, yes, there are portions of the songs in the show that are pre-recorded.
Right.
I tell you this at the beginning of the show when I say, if you notice some enhancement or doctoring in the show, it's not to fool or trick anyone. It's an effort to entertain,
yes,
by being able to have a bigger production and hopefully a better sound.
Yeah.
Which is fair enough. Yeah. That was 2004. Mm-hmm. That was fair enough. But it's a bit strange, isn't it, that in 2004 she was saying, yeah, we do enhance the sound.
Yeah.
But 10 years later, her spokesman's denying. But I agree with you. Does it matter? I think only if the issue is it's only if an artist fibs about it.
That's right. That's absolutely right. Yes. I mean, you pay to go and see a show, and how that show is, what it purports to be is important. And there, but beyond that, how it's stitched together is entirely up to the artist and their sort of live management. And, you know, looked long and hard to find anybody who would deny that Dolly Parton's set at Glastonbury was anything other than a triumph. So, you're churlish indeed to start finding reasons to deny that. The crowd absolutely adored it. The television audience absolutely adored it. Everybody on social media absolutely adored it. Everything else is small beer.
And I think it's a bit of a throwback to ye old days. These days, with technology the way it is, why not use the tools that are available? My guess is I don't know whether Dolly was miming or not. I just asked a friend of mine who was listening to Dolly on Nick Grimshaw this morning,
oh, yeah,
Whether Grimmy asked her the question, and apparently he didn't ask her. It's a shame, really. But I've no idea about Dolly. But in a similar situation, I imagine that the stage mic is kept live at all times, but possibly there's maybe a guide vocal running through her earpiece monitor.
All that is just part of modern
stage technology. Yeah, there's no problem with that.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. And we know that chunks of Madonna's set is pre-recorded when we go and see Madonna, which we don't, but if we did.
Well, indeed. And I think Britney is another artist. I mean, there's an argument for it. If the singer's also performing a sort of gymnastic dancing routine, which Madonna certainly until relatively recently was still doing and many of the younger, bouncier singers do. It's impossible to sing live in any sort of sensible way and be able to do choreography as well. Even in ye olde days of your Morecambe and Wise on the TV, when they used to do a dance routine, and the George Mitchell Singers or somebody would come on and do their high kicking routine. I mean that was pre-recorded. The audio was pre-recorded.
Of course.
So. Yeah. You simply can't do those two things at once.
No, every movie you go and see, the dialogue is re-recorded. Every movie.
I've actually taken part in such a scenario myself where you go in later and add dialogue where necessary.
Yeah,
does it matter if it's a great show? No, it doesn't.
No, that's right. That enormous, enormous crowd that pulled up to the Pyramid Stage did so to be in the presence of Dolly Parton. Everything else is window dressing, you know.
Yes, absolutely. Now, this week, Magnus Shaw, I'll come to you first.
that's a good choice.
Yeah. This week, Jonathan Wall, the youthful controller of BBC Five Live, launched some significant schedule changes. Victoria Derbyshire, Sheila Fogarty and Richard Bacon are all leaving Five Live. Yeah, no changes at breakfast. Then we'll have either Peter Allen or Adrian Charles from 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. With Peter Allen, you'll never need to check the time for yourself, at least between 10 and 1. And then in the afternoon, a completely new show with Sarah Brett from Radio Foyle in Northern Ireland, linking up with the likeable Dan Walker. Now, you discussed one or two of these issues with Jonathan Wall this week, Magnus Shaw.
Yeah, well, I did, briefly. Jonathan Wall was answering questions on various online platforms, and I threw my shillings worth in there. My point was I didn't want to get into how can you get rid of my favourite presenter? Because, you know, that is the default setting for moaning about changes at radio stations. And then, you know, other people saying, yeah, about time too. So, you know, that's you know, grist of the mill. What Mr. Wall has managed to do whilst he's been rejigging the lineup on daytime is excise two female solo-fronted radio programmes in daytime and replace them with male-fronted radio programmes, or at least double-headers.
I was going to say they're double-headers. I don't think you could say that Sarah Brett, I mean, she's very, very good from Radio 4. She won't play second fiddle to Dan Walker.
No, but it is a double-header.
It's a double-header,
You know, which is, however you look at it, in terms of, you know, reflecting gender equality across daytime, is a step backwards. You had Sheila Fogarty and Victoria Derbyshire confronting their shows with guests, but you know the shows were called Sheila Fogarty and Victoria Derbyshire, and now you have none of those. And I think at a time when the BBC is under scrutiny on various matters, and it has been under scrutiny for this kind of thing, it seems a foolish decision, and I cannot believe there is nobody with connections to the BBC or on Mr. Wall's radar who is an exceptional broadcaster and happens to be a woman who he couldn't have you know, brought onto the network.
But apart from the 10 to 1 slot, which I'm not so sure about Peter Allen and Adrian Charles, they're really the success of that. But anyway, the time will tell. You've essentially got man-woman through the day. You've got, you know, Rachel Burden. I mean, she's no shrinking violet by any
sense. It's not her show.
It's not her show, but she's co-hosting it with Nikki Campbell.
Which suggests a loss of nerve, that if the women on the network must be placed with a male presenter. That's what, you know, that's, I'm sure that is not the creative a thrust.
Oh, Magnus Shaw. You could argue the other way as well. You could say, oh, well, we can't trust Dan Walker or Nicky Campbell to be on their own. We must bring in the solid, anchor of a great woman broadcaster. We can't.
But it gives that impression when there are no solo female shows during daytime.
Well, there's only one male show, which is the 10 till 1 shot.
So what you're saying, the creative decision is that it double header shows work better at daytime now, so they're taking away solo shows.
Possibly so. Yeah, seriously, that's possibly it, because it that sort of man woman combination does seem to work quite well, which is why we've got Tony Livesey, the sort of in-form presenter on Five Live, joining Anna Foster for Drive, the 4 to 7 slot, and then with Fighting Talk, the Saturday morning show, which is sports related. I know you don't listen to it, or I don't think you do. You've got, again, same thing, male female, Georgie Thompson from Sky, and Josh Widdicombe presenting Fighting Talk, which actually, I just have to say, that has been a struggle for Five Live since the departure of Colin Murray.
Yeah.
And I didn't really think they knew what they had. You know, don't it always seem to go, you don't know what you've got till it's gone.
Yeah,
Murray was, proved very difficult to replace. But there is a man being replaced with a man and a woman.
Interestingly, that wasn't the defence that the Wall offered.
Oh, what was his defence?
It was a very politician's answer in that, well, there are still women on daytime, just look at the lineup, which wasn't my point. My point was, it's a shame to lose the proprietary female-led shows, shows that belong to women. That seems to be retrograde. And he didn't quite answer the question in that... He posited that, no, there's still lots of women on the network, which wasn't my point. It was specifically about women having their own shows on daytime. And he didn't come back and say, no, what we're doing is introducing more double headers. That wasn't his defence.
But you could, but you could also equally argue, but it could possibly be a stronger argument to say these are all white faces and white voices through the day.
Yes, well, somebody who was... involved in the debate alongside me made that point very strongly that they have lost all ethnic minority voices at daytime completely now. I mean, not in this change around. They'd already gone. Anita Anand and
Asma Mir.
Yeah, Asma Mir as well. Yeah, no,
but they have gone up, but they haven't been dropped. They've gone on better and wider places.
No, I of course, I'm not saying it's a conspiracy, the notion that Five Live have sacked all these people. In fact, quite the opposite. I think their shows have been so successful, other opportunities have now opened up, and they've understandably taken them. But I do think that if you want to represent the nation's demographic, then when you lose women presenters or ethnic minority presenters, then you need to consider whether you should replace them with people from similar communities. Obviously, they have to be talented and capable, as much so as the people that you've lost. And I, very, very hesitant about positive discrimination. But the alternative is to end up with lots of male white faces, stroke voices.
But that's basically what you're arguing for there, because if Jonathan Wall sat with a spreadsheet in front of him, well, let's map out the daytime. Well, I believe in my job that Peter Allen is the best man for mid-morning. And then he has to say to himself, however, I can't employ him. I've got to pick a woman. Now, this woman, the best one we've got here, she's not as good as Peter Allen, without the experience and the all-round knowledge of 20 years on Five Live. But I'm going to pick her because she's a woman.
No, that's exactly what I'm not saying. I specifically said that it's got to be the right person for the job. I just don't believe that you have to go to white men to replace the talent that you're losing with the people leaving.
I wonder if it also has something to do with the fact that there is an absolute insistence this time of no commuting for the new talent. And this is something to do with at least why, Richard Bacon, I mean, he's got a very young family, and I think he just got tired of the daily commute.
Yeah,
it's extraordinary from London to Salford. Victoria Derbyshire, she's received an offer that she can't refuse, which she hasn't announced yet. Sheila Fogarty is the intriguing one. I mean, she's from Liverpool, which, as everybody knows, is only along the road from Manchester. She tried living in Manchester, couldn't settle, but she now lives in Twickenham.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, actually, ironically, around the corner from Peter Salmon, the head of everything BBC North, who's the one exception who doesn't live in the Manchester area whilst running things in it all. But, I don't know if that had anything to do with the recruitment, about the fact that you absolutely had to guarantee that you would live in the area. That's what's... I did just want to note on a sporting front that it's kind of got lost in the Sheila Fogarty, Victoria, Richard Bacon business. The retirement of the excellent Mike Ingham as chief football correspondent. He's really an articulate, erudite, knowledgeable man. But the thing is, he never made the story or the commentary about him. Absolutely excellent. He'll be, I think, a substantial loss to the sports coverage, which I know won't...
No, I don't know the guy at all, but I'll take your word for it. Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of talent going there, and it was the bore down heavy on the station, I think, losing some of those names there. I think, especially when... You know, it's sort of sister station. Radio 2 has all white men through daytime. It would be a shame to move to a similar setup at 5 Live as well. It just seems quite retrograde.
Well, you know, we've trundled along this argument before about 5 Live should never have relocated to Salford. I still stick by that belief. But here's a strange quirk of fate. Radio 4's Woman's Hour is returning to New Broadcasting House in London from Manchester because of the need to reduce costs. That's coming out in the same week as really strange decisions are made at the BBC on these things at the moment. That tedious You and Yours programme is staying in Salford, but they're bringing Woman's Hour back to London.
The BBC operates on a very sort of Orwellian, Kafkaesque basis. There's a lot of double speak and lots of bureaucracy, and the outcomes are as perverse as that would suggest sometimes.
Over the last couple of months, Magnus Shaw, another radio station, Absolute Radio, has brought in something of a groundbreaking change to its breakfast show. Now, it is, of course, a challenge for all radio stations to appeal to as wide an audience as possible, but at the same time not alienating as many listeners as those you attract in. Especially so on music radio, where those who grew up in the 60s may not react too positively to George Ezra or your DJ Fresh, while today's teenager may say meh to the Beatles and the Birds. Absolute Radio has come up with a stylish solution, Magnus Shaw.
It's really interesting. It's the first time I've ever heard of this taking place, and I'm still... without having had the chance to speak to anybody about it, working out the technicalities of how it's being done.
I can fill you in on that in a moment.
Oh, good, because that's really where my fascination lies. But it's essentially, for anybody who doesn't know, if you listen to Absolute Radio at breakfast, you get Christine O'Connell and his rib-tickling bon mots throughout the morning and various advertiser-sponsored competitions. But... in terms of music, you can choose what you hear by genre. So the links are the same, but you can listen to the breakfast show with an 80s soundtrack or with a 90s soundtrack or with a contemporary. You might wonder, well, how on earth does that work? Well, that's kind of what I'm wondering as well. But perhaps you can fill us in on the technicalities there.
Yes, well, as with many changes to radio, I'm grateful to my pal, the peerless James Cridland, for helping me understand how it works. Absolute Radio call it Project Banana, as in banana split.
Phil Shrew's confidence, doesn't it?
Yeah, no, it's Absolute use a playout system called Genesis, and it had already been programmed to synchronize playouts of 8 different sets of commercials to regional audiences. Yeah. Now, that's a little bit easier to understand because they'll generally be of the same length, so just a question of setting up the software. Now, Genesis has been programmed to play out different songs across Absolute 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, noughties, and classic rock. So Christian O'Connell, the Breakfast Show presenter, speaks live across the network, but a different song choice is played across each channel.
Yeah.
Now, O'Connell can see what's being played on a monitor, you know, on each of the different stations, and it all happens automatically based on the duration of each song.
That's my burning point, really. I'm absolutely clear how it can be done with commercials because they are sold in 20, 30, 40 second slots, usually radio commercials. And so it doesn't matter whether you get 20 seconds of double glazing or 20 seconds of baked beans. It doesn't matter that they fill the same 20 seconds of available air, but records are all of random length.
So you would think that it would prove a difficulty, and in a way it does, because you know, one would think, well, okay, we've got to find a 3-minute Beatles track for Absolute 60s and a 3-minute 0 seconds Lady Gaga track.
Yeah, the point's 3 minutes 43 or whatever.
Or whatever. And you think, well, can the software cope with that? And the answer is, having listened to it, no, it can't. My question was,
how does it work if it works? So it's easy to make it work if it doesn't work.
That's right. It doesn't work as smoothly as perhaps we should hope, because this morning I listened to Absolute 70s with Christian O'Connell, and also the live, you know, the main channel, And I thought, now this is weird, because on the main channel there was some current song, and starting up at the same time on Absolute 70s was Steely Dan's Do It Again. And I thought, well, that's quite a long track. How's this going to work? And as I found with Steely Dan, and then subsequently as well, Don't Fear the Reaper by your Blue Oyster Cult, all they do is fade it down.
Yeah, I thought one track in the stack would take precedence, and everything would conform to the duration of that track. That's the only way it could be done. That's exactly as I pictured it. Yeah.
And that's exactly what happens. And also, I thought that of course, the one thing that Christine O'Connell can't do is he can't announce and back announce any tracks, which also lends itself to a strange sort of sound. And how they get around that is a couple of ways. One is occasionally he does back announce what's been on the main channel. So he actually said, well, there we heard Kasabian on the main channel, and they are, of course, appearing in Hyde Park, blah, blah, blah. Which is one thing. The other thing they do is...
hold on. What if you're hearing that off the back of Steve Dan's Reeling in the Ears?
I was. Oh. That's exactly what happened. That's what I mean. Oh, he ignores the whole process at times, because, as I actually did come out of Steely Dan's Reeling in the Ears with Christine O'Connell saying, well, on the main channel just then, we heard Kasabian.
That's terrible.
Which made me feel a bit alienated. Yeah, I thought, well, I wasn't.
That's hopeless.
But the other strange thing is, I've got the feeling, I don't know, I didn't listen, but I listened to about an hour. I think there is also pre-recorded little snippets of voice tracking as well to help fill in the gaps where needed. And I think the software does this automatically, because at one point on the live channel, he said, now let's crack on. And then in a different point on the 70s channel, between some commercials and another track, he said, now let's crack on.
Yeah.
So I think, again, there must be little 3 second, 5 second, 10 second, 12 second sound bites that also help with this. So it's an interesting concept. Whether it's worth listening to on two different channels to see how it works.
Yes, absolutely.
It's not as smooth as perhaps one would wish for, but it kind of works. I still got, if it had been my thing, I still got Christian O'Connell mucking about with his zoo-like colleagues, but instead of Kasabian, I got Don't Fear the Reaper. So
that the concept holds a lot of water, unless you're a complete revolutionary and you say, well, this indicates there's no need for presenter-led music radio, which you could argue
the way it's heading
in the wrong direction.
Well, you could say that's what's happened, because some will say, well, there's half a dozen disc jockey presenter jobs axed from all those other niche stations.
Yes.
But other may hail it as a clever and innovative leap into the future,
The less complicated and presumably much less expensive option would be, no presenter on any of those networks. just like the American model of
jukebox,
45 minutes of music and then a pre-recorded presenter telling you what you've just heard and who you and which station you're listening to, etc. and
which I would prefer, frankly. I
absolutely see the argument for that, because clearly Absolute are trying to establish the alternative to that, but it sounds a bit of a slightly wobbly start. But maybe when everybody gets used to it, listeners and technicals, producers and presenters alike, maybe it will form in.
It may smooth out a bit. The only way that this sort of radio will survive is with personality presenters, because if they had half a dozen people doing 60-70 days, really the last thing I would want to hear when I'm going between the Doobie Brothers and Joni Mitchell is some person go, well, there you go, that's the big sound of the Doobie Brothers, and on we go to Joni Mitchell. There's nothing worse. Well, so if you've got a personality presenter like Jeff Lloyd or Christian O'Connell himself, this is the only way it'll work, in that they're the feature of the 3 hours, and the music comes in to support them rather than the other way around.
Yeah, it just makes you wonder how many radio presenters of that caliber or of that type that are available to all the stations in the country, in that people will access their programs to hear them. There's not many presenters who have that sort of cachet, is there? I would argue
there's not. I mean, I found him unlistenable, but Chris Moyles was probably one of the major players in that genre. Yeah. He had that kind of following where they didn't care if he spoke without playing any music for half an hour, so long as he and his pals were amusing.
God help us,
God help us. But they rarely stand still at Absolute Radio and Bauer Media. This is probably part of ongoing developments. Next year, Christian O'Connell on the moon, or Jeff Lloyd does Drive Time from his car. These are all possibilities.
Well, it'd be interesting to see how that one rolls out. It's brave. It's certainly interesting to see a commercial station trying something completely different, because the model for commercial radio these days tends to be spectacularly predictable, so at least it's not that.
Give it a listen in the park when you're releasing your 99 Luftballon.
I shall attempt to do just that.
Back in the summer of 2002, Magna Shaw. One of my friends told me that she'd taken in a woman to come and live in a spare room in her house, and I told her she'd done a very kind thing. The woman had lost her boyfriend, her partner, I suppose, in the 9/11 Twin Towers attack in 2001. Okay. Yeah, he'd been at work and died when one of the planes struck, yeah. And my friend Annette took this woman in as the woman was suffering such stress, and she let her stay for free as she tried to recover from her ordeal. Yeah. Except over the weeks, this stranger story began to unravel in the detail,
right.
Until one day she admitted she'd made the whole thing
up. No, really?
And had simply taken advantage of Annette's kindness, which's leading to the question, why on earth would anyone do such a thing? On Wednesday, on ITV, an hour-long programme, The Betrayers, took a look at people who've duped others with similar stories, Magna Shaw.
Mm. Yeah, well, it was the stories were riveting, weren't they? I mean, the whole show was a little bit overdramatic, as these things tend to be, particularly on the commercial channels. But I get in this instance, the stories warranted some of that drama because they were quite extraordinary, weren't they? The first one that rolled out was, I suppose, if there is a classic of the genre, then it was the one we know so well, wasn't it? And there have been quite a few people who've been caught up and indeed who've done this. It's almost without exception, it's a guy duping women, although not always, but in the main. And then this was one. I think...
David Checkley.
Yeah, David Checkley, yeah. I think there's a golden rule that I took from the David Checkley story, and that was never believe anyone who says they worked in military intelligence and can't talk about it. As soon as somebody says that should be your first red flag, shouldn't it, really? But, you know, these women did believe him, and I in no way blame these women. I think it's so easy to say, well, you had it coming. You know, how stupid are you? Because you just never know. There's some very credible people out there who are just not what they seem to be, and it could happen. It absolutely could happen to anybody. And the desire for companionship is a base human desire, and sometimes you overlook the obvious if you think that desire is going to be fulfilled. But
should we explain to anybody who didn't watch it, what happened was that this David Checkley used dating websites to meet up with a lot of women and formed relationships with them. In one case, a lady, Susan, who lost £20,000, a six-month relationship, and told them, as you just said, all the, you know, this sort of glittering lifestyle and mysterious career that he had. And, of course, drew them in and then told them that he needed money for this, that and the other, by which time they thought they were engaged to him, and of course as we know, never saw the money again.
Absolutely. And they signed over houses to him and all sorts of incredible things. And an aspect of the documentary that I thought necessary was the introduction of Asian psychologist or psychiatrist. I don't know why they all bother with this, and I know that it gives the program an air of sort of forensic credibility, but they always say things that we're all sat there thinking. I've never very rarely seen any proper insight from one of these television psychologists, and there was the case here as well. She diagnosed this guy, well, he's a narcissist and borderline sociopath and da da da. She'd never met the guy or had him as a patient or a client. She's no idea at all, and she was just guessing at what the diagnosis would be had she done that, just the same as we would. And to say that he was vain and egotistical and out for to manipulate and control these women is ridiculous. The story tells you that, so she was completely superfluous.
She was. She said one thing which reinforced what you said. She said, well, with David Checkley, it was all about power, omnipotence and control.
Yeah.
And I thought, well, what, have you got a degree to figure that out?
What else would it be about?
What else would it be about?
Yeah, so she wasn't needed at all.
this fellow devastated, I think it was about 20 women's lives. And here was the bit that made my hair stand on end. And they said, and David Checkley was given a 6 years, 10 month prison sentence. And he was released in 2013 after serving 3 years and 9 months.
I've got that written down myself here, yeah.
And I thought, I was expecting, and he's currently serving a 25-year sentence in a high security. He's back out on the street 6 months, living in North London.
Nobody knows where, and there's every chance that he's roaming the digital avenues of dating websites all over again. And what it made me think was that it was almost worth it from his point of view. Mm. You know, if he accumulated, let's say £1.5 million,
from absolutely
his activities, then he's flogged 3 years, 9 months of his life for £1.5 million. That might have been part of his calculation,
and it may even have been part of the calculation of the second person that was featured, Alistair Stewart, who made himself known as Alexander Stewart, a con man living the high life in the Turks and Caicos Islands. When he actually came Burgess Hill, unemployed, living in a bedsit in Burgess Hill, because he conned this poor woman. I mean, my heart went out to her, out of £1 million.
I know. When she said the words to camera, and it was at that point I sent him $1 million. My blood ran cold. You know, it's just the words $1 million is what triggers that reaction, isn't it? Just awful.
Five and a half years. He's still in jail. 5.5 years. So again, if on the principle that you get out, about halfway through, that's just over 2 years to earn $1 million. To purloin $1 million.
Yeah, some people would take that deal, wouldn't they?
They would.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, yeah. Yes, I mean, there were lessons to be learned all the way through. And I don't mean that patronising. I mean, these are tales of caution, aren't they? Because I do believe they can happen to almost anybody. I think, be cautious of people who tell you they've died was the one from the Stewart case, I think. Because it was what he ended up doing, wasn't it? When the heat got a bit much, he kind of sent communications purporting to be from other people saying, your boyfriend, is Alistair or Alex, as he was going back. Yeah. Oh, he's died. He's had two strokes and he's died. If somebody's got your money and you get a message saying they've died, you'd have to ask very carefully whether look very closely whether they actually have. And in the first case, try not to lend money to people who send you photographs of their downstairs department, which is what he was
doing. Indeed, that's what David Checkley did. That's right. There were a couple of other stories featured. One was a sort of tack on at the end. It lasted about 2 minutes, about a boxer who tried to burn his family house down. Not so good. But just one other quick one, a horrifying story of a woman called Beth Hood, who took money from a family where the father was dying, and then moved into their home. And, she took incredible advantage of them. And then, just to reiterate the point, she behaved abominably. And she was sentenced to 18 months in prison, suspended for 3 years. Yeah. And as one of the family said, well, she won.
Yeah.
Because, that she just walked out of the court laughing.
Yeah, literally walked out of the court laughing. Yeah. Yes, yes. Yes, I know the punishment for this kind of deception didn't seem to stack up, did it, at all? Defraud a bank or an insurance company and they'll throw the book at you, but it seems like it's okay to defraud generous or vulnerable people. The boxing kid, I think we saw his father saying, when it came down to it, I forgave him and welcomed him back, because that's what you do for your children, which I thought was very noble. I didn't see the gratitude, relief, and humility reflected in the kid who'd been forgiven, unfortunately.
No, not at all. He was given, this is again, he was given a life sentence for arson, for trying to burn down his family home with his family in it. And he was released after 8 years. You know, and he's back, I think, you know, in the pocket of his family.
Well, yeah, that's more to the point that his family then welcomed him back. I think he's, you know, he's very, very lucky and probably doesn't realise it. And maybe, maybe he should. But it was the cautionary tales are plenty here, weren't there? It was
It takes me back, as I say, to my dear, you know, my poor dear friend who was an act of kindness. Absolutely true story.
Yeah, and it was reflected in the States. There was a woman who claimed she had been in the World Trade Center on September 11th, 2001, and sort of headed a survivors group, you know, comforting and raising money for people who had been affected by the attacks. And eventually, exactly the same thing. She had been nowhere near the World Trade Center. She wasn't a survivor. And it had all been a put-up job. So just incredible the way people...
It really is. This was an odd little program. It made me. I think it was a World Cup filler because it made me think of the sort of programs that you see on CBS Reality and their ilk.
Yeah.
Any night of the week, but here it was on mainstream ITV.
Yes. I mean, it's good. It's good sort of telly candy, isn't it? Not for the poor people involved, but I mean, I could watch these things quite happily, I must say. They have a certain allure, don't they? Yeah.
They do. This was The Betrayers on ITV last Wednesday at 9:00 p.m. Narrated by Rhys Shearsmith and produced by Paul Hammon for Wild Pictures.
Yes, must have been a bit of a bit of pub money, bit of beer money for Rhys Shearsmith, because you know he's a high profile guy. I just imagine him having lunch in Covent Garden and getting a call on his mobile saying, "If you've got 2 hours this afternoon, there's a few grand in it," and he popped down to a voice booth and did the whole thing.
Yeah.
I've no idea whether that was the case, but I just thought he was an incredibly high-profile name to be attached to, as you say, a filler program.
It was an odd bit of casting.
You're listening to a podcast from the Rocking Vicar.
Now, Mechnashaw, the usual thing has happened at this stage in the proceedings. Apparently, Dolly Parton, Jonathan Wall of Five Live, Naina and her Naina, she's been on with her Noin and Noinsick Luftballons. Christian O'Connell, he's been on, and also Sheila Fogarty. They've all been on and said they think it's about time that we moved on to the closing feature, Pretend iPod. I think they're right. This is where you know we choose a piece of music each, explain why we like it so terribly much, and it joins a massive playlist on the Rocking Vicar website. And also, for new listeners, I should let them know that it's also available on Spotify under your name, and that name is Mechnashaw.
Yes, it is indeed. And I'm up first, I believe, this week.
That was your cue.
Yes. Never take a cue when you can miss it. That's my rule. Well, let's talk about Bruce Springsteen, shall we? Bruce Springsteen, I think, I think anybody would agree, is largely associated with huge, bombastic slabs of rock and roll, and nothing wrong with that. But for my money, he's always at his best when he's a little bit more subdued and subtle. And doing the kind of material for which he's less associated, you know, maybe that's my perverse nature, but I'm drawn to it when Bruce is in a more thoughtful mood. And he's rarely been more thoughtful and subdued than on 1993's The Streets of Philadelphia. It was recorded for a movie I think everybody still remembers, actually. Amazing that it was 1993. The film was called Philadelphia, starred Tom Hanks, and it was really Hollywood's first reaction to the AIDS crisis in the States. And as a consequence, this isn't Bruce delivering those huge global political broadsides that he does so well. He's really rather addressing painfully intimate personal politics, which of course the film does as well. Specifically, as I say, the contemporary agonies of HIV that were rearing their head in the mid-90s. That lyrically, this is an authentically desperate and bleak song, and some of Springsteen's best lyrics, I think. Let me just give you a few here. I walked the avenue till my legs felt like stone. I heard the voices of friends vanished and gone. At night, I could hear the blood in my veins black and whispering as the rain on the streets of Philadelphia. We're a long way, clearly, from Dancing in the Dark here, but that is no bad thing. I love Springsteen in this sort of mood. He doesn't go there all that often, but when he does, it is tremendous, because it shows him, I think, at his most compassionate and poetic and really human. He doesn't sound like a rock star when he's doing this. Instead, he's sort of brilliantly and believably singing with the voice of the lost and the frightened and the abandoned and the neglected. He may be playing a part in doing that. He himself is none of those things, but he plays it with real sensitivity and an emotion that you can sometimes really feel in your stomach. He's very good at adopting that voice. On this track, there's a recumbent backing of like muted organ and pacing insistent drums, which sort of reflects the idea of him pacing the streets to Philadelphia in this terrible state. They all perfectly add up to this aching atmosphere. There's a spectral choir echoing the voices of perhaps people he's thinking of who've completed their journey through HIV/AIDS. A very, very stirring piece. If you're compiling a party mixtape, how old am I, but you know what I mean, a playlist, you may want to skip this. But if you want a dramatic, heartfelt, thought-provoking track from an obviously tremendous artist, this is where you'll be heading. It's my pick this week, Bruce Springsteen's extraordinary The Streets of Philadelphia.
Yes, it's a very reflective piece for Bruce, as you say, sort of emotional and lyrical in the broadest sense of that word. I actually saw the movie in America. I was staying in America around this time.
Yeah.
And it was a very affecting moment. I mean, anybody today, I mean, that wasn't, of adult years in sort of 93, 94, we did all wonder where this HIV/AIDS epidemic, I suppose one could say, was going to take us. And this was a very affecting film. And I remember people coming out of the movie theatre in America with me, seriously and literally in tears.
Yes.
Because of the movie. And the song does reflect that. And the video for Bruce's Streets of Philadelphia, rather than the film, is also in kind of tune with that mood, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's sort of very pensive and, as you say, not Bruce kind of showboating
at all. No. He's wearing a rather splendid biker jacket hoodie combo in the video.
Yes. Yeah,
I think Bruce can go to these places and without appearing mawkish or patronizing. He does have that ability to speak of these subjects which don't affect him directly, so it sort of makes him a bit of an actor, but I don't mean that in a pejorative way. I think it makes him a very astute actor when he takes the voice of other people like this.
I love Bruce in that vein. There's some musicians from earlier generations who were, indeed are, Renaissance men and women, turning their talents to a range of tasks and opportunities as they present themselves. One of the finest examples of what I mean is Dave Edmunds. He would pop up in bands, then he'd produce some hits for others, guest on guitar on yet more hits, turn up in someone's backing band on Top of the Pops, and then, seemingly just for a lark, bang out a few hit singles under his own name when he felt like it. Pub rock from the mid-70s is often derided now, and it's fallen into popular belief that it only consisted of tired musicians knocking out 12-bar blues or perhaps covering the New Riders of the Purple Sage. One of the truly great bands to crawl from the wreckage of that era was
Rock. See what you did there.
was Rockpile, comprising of Terry Williams on drums, the excellent Billy Bremner on guitar, Nick Lowe on bass, and Dave Edmonds also on guitar. All of them except Williams provided vocals. They were a great unit live. I saw them in all sorts of places, from pubs and even supporting Bad Company on a tour in big venues. Edmonds and Lowe in particular were like a cottage industry in those punk years, not really part of the punk era at all, but retaining credibility, and they were the sort of go-to guys if you needed musicianship or an experienced producer. Dave Edmonds, you know, talking about his versatility, he even pops up in Paul McCartney's band in the rather awkward Give My Regards to Broad Street movie and soundtrack. Now, speaking of Paul McCartney, there was a period between 1962 and 65 when Paul was essentially chucking away songs for other artists to have hits, Cilla, Peter and Gordon, Billy J. Kramer and so on. In the mid-70s to early 80s, Elvis Costello had a similar magical run where he had more songs around than he knew what to do with, and he gave them away to Dusty Springfield, Wendy James, Tracy, Was Not Was, Paul McCartney, curiously, and Dave Edmonds. And in 1979, Dave Edmonds put together an album called Repeat When Necessary, with that classic Rockpile lineup of Bremner, Williams and Lowe. But it was released under his own name, and I'm choosing from that album the hit single written by, as I say, Elvis Costello, recorded February 1979, released in June 1979. It reached number 65 on the Billboard Hot 100 and number 4 on the UK Top 40, 3 minutes, 25 seconds. Dave Edmonds, Girls Talk.
Yeah, it's really good. I think Nick Lowe, Dave Edmonds, Elvis Costello, they all have that sort of tight guitar-led R&B feel, don't they? You can draw a line through those three artists, perhaps more besides.
Yes, and I think Dave Edmonds and Nick Lowe in particular, they were sort of part of a kind of, in the widest sense of the word, a group. Mm. Where sort of Brinsley Schwartz,
yeah.
You know, and yes, and Nick Lowe and Love Sculpture, of course, with Edmonds, that grew out of the London pub scene, I suppose. But what it did do to sort of endorse what you're saying, really, is that it was rather like, you know, that one, what was it, 10,000 hours of Gladwell,
that's right.
In that playing so incessantly together in the pubs and clubs of London, they just formed such tight units,
yeah,
between themselves,
yeah.
And that's how I think they were able to turn their hand to anything, as I say, particularly in the case of Dave Edmonds, you know, say, oh, well, what, you know, the mortgage is due, I suppose I better have another hit,
yes,
you know, and it just seemed to think, okay, well, let's just go and do
that. Yeah, because you've got Girls Talk, you've got, no, noticed you slipped that in there, Crawling From the Wreckage, which I think is a fantastic record, and Queen of Hearts as well.
I hear you knocking.
Yeah,
I knew the bride.
That's,
I knew the bride.
Right,
when,
yeah,
she,
it's amazing how
roll,
many there are when you start topping them up. Really,
oh, yes.
It's very good. Yeah, good pick. I mean, brilliantly written Elvis Costello song. You know, loses nothing for the performance from Dave Edmonds. In fact, he probably nails it. I'm sure I've heard Elvis Costello do Girls Talk as well, haven't I? That's,
oh, he does. Yeah. Yes, he has recorded it.
Yeah,
yes.
Yeah. But, you know, hard to pick between the two. So, yeah, good call. Well, there you go then. Another brace of splendid records uploaded to that database tagged The Pretend iPod, which unfortunately means it's time to pop on our pointy hats and board the magic bus for Normandy's biannual Pixie Festival taking place this weekend. So it's thanks to the elegance, Terence Dackham.
Be seeing you.
And to Rona Martin for her delicious introduction, as always. And also to you, big thanks to our favourite listener. And we'll be back very soon, I should say. Until then, bye-bye.
and battered, I couldn't tell what I felt. I was unrecognizable to myself. Saw my reflection in a window and didn't know my own face. Oh brother, gonna leave me wasting away on the streets of Philadelphia. Like stone, I heard voices of friends vanished and gone. At night I could hear the blood in my veins, just as black and whispering as the rain on the streets of Philadelphia.
Listening to a Dacom Shore Media Production.
Absolute on power drive. Need you so to keep me alive. Absolute, I long for you, a girl to make a